Imeros in the marketplace.
I don't suppose he knows even now how it happened, Stern said.
He wiped away a drop of wine that ran down the side of his cup and drank again.
Perhaps she didn't know either. Or perhaps she planned it from the moment she saw him.
In any case, 6 months later, the city of Habana was agog at the news that the young wife of Don Armando Alcantara had run away with a priest.
And her mother,
I said under my breath. But he heard me and smiled slightly.
Hermenegilda would never leave Mamacita behind, he said, nor her dog Ludo.
They would never have succeeded in escaping, for the reach of Don Armando was long and powerful. Save for the fact that the English conveniently chose the day of their elopement to invade the island of Cuba, and Don Armando had many things more important to worry him than the whereabouts of his runaway young wife. The fugitives rode to Bayamo, much hampered by Hermenegilda's dresses, with which she wouldn't part, and there hired a fishing boat, which carried them to safety on Hispaniola.
She died 2 years later,
Stern said abruptly. He set down his cup and refilled it from the sweating pitcher.
He buried her himself under the bougainvillea.
And here they've stayed since? I said. The priest and Ludo and Mamacita?
Oh, yes.
Stern closed his eyes, his profile dark against the setting sun.
Hermenegilda would not leave Mamacita, and Mamacita will never leave Hermenegilda.
He tossed back the rest of his cup of sangria.
No one comes here, he said. The villagers won't set foot on the hill. They're afraid of Hermenegilda's ghost. A damned sinner, buried by a reprobate priest in unhallowed ground. Of course she will not lie quiet.
The sea breeze was cool on the back of my neck. Behind us, even the chickens in the patio had grown quiet with falling twilight. The Hacienda de la Fuente lay still.
You come, I said,
and he smiled. The scent of oranges rose up from the empty cup in my hands, sweet as bridal flowers.
Ah, well, he said, I am a scientist. I don't believe in ghosts.
He extended a hand to me somewhat unsteadily.
Shall we dine, Mrs. Fraser?
After breakfast the next morning, Stern was ready to set off for Saint Louis. Before leaving, though, I had a question or two about the ship the priest had mentioned. If it were the Porpoise, I wanted to steer clear of it. What sort of ship was it? I asked, pouring a cup of goat's milk to go with the breakfast of fried plantain. Father Fogden, apparently little the worse for his excesses of the day before, was stroking his coconut, humming dreamily to himself.
Ah?
He said, startled out of his reverie by Stern's poking him in the ribs. I patiently repeated my query.
Oh.
He squinted in deep thought, then his face relaxed.
A wooden one.
Lawrence bent his broad face over his plate, hiding a smile. I took a breath and tried again. The sailors who killed Arabella, did you see them? His narrow brows rose.
Well, of course I saw them. How else would I know they'd done it?
I seized on this evidence of logical thought. Naturally. And did you see what they were wearing? I mean, I saw him opening his mouth to say clothes and hastily forestalled him. Did they seem to be wearing any sort of uniform? The crew of the Porpoise commonly wore slops when not performing any ceremonial duty, but even these rough clothes bore the semblance of a uniform, being mostly all of a dirty white and similar in cut. Father Fogden laid down his cup, leaving a milky moustache across his upper lip. He brushed at this with the back of his hand, frowning and shaking his head.
No, I think not. All I recall of them, though, is that the leader wore a hook. Missing a hand, I mean.
He waggled his own long fingers at me in illustration. I dropped my cup, which exploded on the tabletop. Stern sprang up with an exclamation, but the priest sat still, watching in surprise as a thin white stream ran across the table and into his lap.
"Whatever did you do that for?"
he said reproachfully.
"I'm sorry," I said.
My hands were trembling so that I couldn't even manage to pick up the shards of the shattered cup. I was afraid to ask the next question. "Father, has the ship sailed away?"
"Why, no," he said,
looking up in surprise from his damp robe.
"How could it? It's on the beach."
Father Fogden led the way, his skinny shanks a gleaming white as he kirtled his cassock about his thighs. I was obliged to do the same, for the hillside above the house was thick with grass and thorny shrubs that caught at the coarse wool skirts of my borrowed robe. The hill was criss-crossed with sheep paths, but these were narrow and faint, losing themselves under the trees and disappearing abruptly in thick grass. The priest seemed confident about his destination, though, and scampered briskly through the vegetation, never looking back. I was breathing hard by the time we reached the crest of the hill, even though Lawrence Stern had gallantly assisted me, pushing branches out of my way and taking my arm to haul me up the steeper slopes. "Do you think there really is a ship?" I said to him, low-voiced, as we approached the top of the hill. Given our host's behaviour so far, I wasn't so sure he mightn't have imagined it, just to be sociable. Stern shrugged, wiping a trickle of sweat that ran down his bronzed cheek.
"I suppose there will be something there," he replied. "After all, there is a dead sheep."
A qualm ran over me in memory of the late departed Arabella. Someone had killed the sheep, and I walked as quietly as I could as we approached the top of the hill. It couldn't be the porpoise. None of her officers or men wore a hook. I tried to tell myself that it likely wasn't the Artemis either, but my heart beat still faster as we came to a stand of giant agave on the crest of the hill. I could see the Caribbean glowing blue through the succulent's branches, and a narrow strip of white beach. Father Fogden had come to a halt, beckoning us to his side.
"There they are, the wicked creatures," he muttered.
His blue eyes glittered bright with fury, and his scanty hair fairly bristled like a moth-eaten porcupine.
"Butchers,"
he said, hushed but vehement, as though talking to himself.
"Cannibals."
I gave him a startled look, but then Lawrence Stern grasped my arm, drawing me to a wider opening between two trees.
"Oi, there is a ship," he said.
There was. It was lying tilted on its side, drawn up on the beach, its masts unstepped, untidy piles of cargo, sails, rigging, and water casks scattered all about it. Men crawled over the beached carcass like ants. Shouts and hammer blows rang out like gunshots, and the smell of hot pitch was thick on the air. The unloaded cargo gleamed dully in the sun, copper and tin slightly tarnished by the sea air. Tanned hides had been laid flat on the sand, brown, stiff blotches drying in the sun.
"It is them. It's the Artemis."
The matter was settled by the appearance near the hull of a squat, one-legged figure, head shaded from the sun by a gaudy kerchief of yellow silk.
"Murphy!" I shouted. "Fergus! Jamie!"
I broke from Stern's grasp and ran down the far side of the hill, his cry of caution disregarded in the excitement of seeing the Artemis. Murphy whirled at my shout but was unable to get out of my way. Carried by momentum and moving like a runaway freight, I crashed straight into him, knocking him flat.
"Murphy,"
I said, and kissed him, caught up in the joy of the moment.
"Oi,"
he said, shocked. He wriggled madly, trying to get out from under me.
"Me lady."
Fergus appeared at my side, crumpled and vivid, his beautiful smile dazzling in a sun-dark face.
"Me lady."
He helped me off the grunting Murphy, then grabbed me to him in a rib-cracking hug. Massali appeared behind him, a broad smile on her face.
"Merci, old saint,"
he said in my ear.
I was afraid we would never see you again.
He kissed me heartily himself, on both cheeks and the mouth, then released me at last. I glanced at the Artemis, lying on her side on the beach like a stranded beetle. What on earth happened? Fergus and Massali exchanged a glance. It was the sort of look in which questions are asked and answered, and it rather startled me to see the depths of intimacy between them. Fergus drew a deep breath and turned to me.
"Captain Rains is dead," he said.
The storm that had come upon me during my night in the mangrove swamp had also struck the Artemis. Carried far off her path by the howling wind, she had been forced over a reef, tearing a sizable hole in her bottom. Still, she had remained afloat. The aft hold filling rapidly, she had limped toward the small inlet that opened so near, offering shelter.
"We were no more than 300 yards from the shore when the accident happened," Fergus said,
his face drawn by the memory. The ship had heeled suddenly over as the contents of the aft hold had shifted, beginning to float. And just then, an enormous wave, coming from the sea, had struck the leaning ship, washing across the tilting quarterdeck, and carrying away Captain Rains and 4 seamen with him.
"The shore was so near," Massali said, her face twisted with distress. "We were aground 10 minutes later. If only..."
Fergus stopped her with a hand on her arm.
"We cannot guess God's ways," he said. "It would have been the same if we had been 1,000 miles at sea. Save we would not have been able to give them decent burial."
He nodded toward the far edge of the beach, near the jungle, where 5 small mounds, topped with crude wooden crosses, marked the final resting places of the drowned men.
"I had some holy water that Dar brought me from Notre Dame in Paris," Massali said.
Her lips were cracked, and she licked them.
"In a little bottle. I said a prayer, and sprinkled it on the graves. Do you think they would have liked that?"
I caught the quaver in her voice, and realised that for all her self-possession, the last 2 days had been a terrifying ordeal for the girl. Her face was grimy, her hair coming down, and the sharpness was gone from her eyes, softened by tears.
"I'm sure they would," I said gently, patting her arm.
I glanced at the faces crowding around, searching for Jamie's great height and fiery head, even as the realization dawned that he wasn't there.
"Where is Jamie?" I said.
My face was flushed from the run down the hill. I felt the blood begin to drain from my cheeks as a trickle of fear rose in my veins. Fergus was staring at me.
"He is not with you," he said.
"No! How could he be?"
The sun was blinding, but my skin felt cold. I could feel the heat shimmer over me, but to no effect. My lips were so chilled I could scarcely form the question.
"Where is he?"
Fergus shook his head slowly back and forth, like an ox stunned by the slaughterer's blow.
"I do not know."
Chapter 51, in which Jamie smells a rat. Jamie Fraser lay in the shadows under the porpoise's jolly boat, chest heaving with effort. Getting aboard the man-o'-war without being seen had been no small task. His right side was bruised from being slammed against the side of the ship as he hung from the boarding nets, struggling to pull himself up to the rail. His arms felt as though they'd been jerked from their sockets, and there was a large splinter in one hand. But he was here, and so far, unseen. He chewed delicately at his palm, groping for the end of the splinter with his teeth as he got his bearings. Rousseau and Stone, Artemis's hands, who had served aboard men-o'-war, had spent hours describing to him the structure of a large ship, the compartments and decks, and the probable location of the surgeon's quarters. Hearing something described and being able to find your way about in it were 2 different things, though. At least the miserable thing rocked less than the Artemis, though he could still feel the subtle, nauseating heave of the deck beneath him.
The end of the splinter worked free. Nipping it between his teeth, he drew it slowly out and spat it on the deck. He sucked the tiny wound, tasting blood, and slid cautiously out from under the jolly boat, ears pricked to catch the sound of an approaching footstep.
The deck below this one, down the forward companionway. The officers' quarters would be there, and with luck the surgeon's cabin as well. Not that she was likely to be in her quarters. Not her. She'd cared enough to come tend the sick. She would be with them.
He had waited until dark to have Robbie McCrae row him out. Rains had told him that the paupers would likely weigh anchor with the evening tide 2 hours from now. If he could find Claire and escape over the side before that, he could swim ashore with her easily. The Artemis would be waiting for them, concealed in a small cove on the other side of Caicos Island. If he couldn't, well, he would deal with that when he came to it. Fresh from the cramped small world of the Artemis, the below decks of the paupers seemed huge and sprawling. A shadowed warren. He stood still, nostrils flaring, as he deliberately drew the fetid air deep into his lungs. There were all the nasty stenches associated with a ship at sea for a long time, overlaid with the faint floating stink of feces and vomit. He turned to the left and began to walk softly, long nose twitching. Where the smell of sickness was the strongest, that was where he would find her. 4 hours later, in mounting desperation, he made his way aft for the third time. He had covered the entire ship, keeping out of sight with some difficulty, and Claire was nowhere to be found.
"Bloody woman," he said under his breath. "Where have you gone, you fascist wee Heidi?"
A small worm of fear gnawed at the base of his heart. She had said her vaccine would protect her from the sickness, but what if she'd been wrong? He could see for himself that the man-o'-war's crew had been badly diminished by the deadly sickness. Knee-deep in it. The germs might have attacked her too, vaccine or not. He thought of germs as small blind things, about the size of maggots, but equipped with vicious razor teeth like tiny sharks. He could all too easily imagine a swarm of the things fastening onto her, killing her, draining her flesh of life. It was just such a vision that had made him pursue the porpoise. That, and a murderous rage toward the English buggerer who had had the filth-eating insolence to steal away his wife beneath his very nose, with a vague promise to return her, once they'd made use of her. Leave her to the Sassenachs, unprotected? "Not bloody likely," he muttered under his breath, dropping down into a dark cargo space. She wouldn't be in such a place, of course, but he must think a moment what to do. Was this the cable tier, the aft cargo hatch, the forward stinking God knew what? Christ, he hated boots! He drew in a deep breath and stopped, surprised. There were animals here. Goats. He could smell them plainly. There was also a light dimly visible around the edges of a bulkhead and the murmur of voices. Was one of them a woman's voice? He edged forward, listening. There were feet on the deck above, a patter and thump that he recognised. Bodies dropping from the rigging. Had someone above seen him? Well, and if they had? It was no crime, so far as he knew, for a man to come seeking his wife. The porpoise was a sail. He had felt the thrum of the sails passing through the wood all the way to the keel as she took the wind. They had long since missed the rendezvous with the Artemis. That being so, there was likely nothing to lose by appearing boldly before the captain and demanding to see Claire. But perhaps she was here. It was a woman's voice. It was a woman's figure, too, silhouetted against the lantern's light. But the woman wasn't Claire. His heart leapt convulsively at the gleam of light on her hair, but then fell at once as he saw the thick, square shape of the woman by the goat pen. There was a man with her. As Jamie watched, the man bent and picked up a basket. He turned and came toward Jamie. He stepped into the narrow aisle between the bulkheads, blocking the seaman's way.
"Here, what do you mean?"
the man began, and then, raising his eyes to Jamie's face, stopped, gasping.
One eye was fixed on him in horrified recognition. The other showed only as a bluish-white crescent beneath the withered lid.
"God preserve us," the seaman said. "What are you doing here?"
The seaman's face gleamed pale and jaundiced in the dim light.
"You ken me, do you?"
Jamie's heart was hammering against his ribs, but he kept his voice level and low.
"I have not the honour to know your own name, I think. I would prefer to leave that particular circumstance unchanged, Your Honour, if you've no objection."
The one-eyed seaman began to edge backward, but was forestalled as Jamie gripped his arm hard enough to elicit a small yelp.
"Not quite so fast, if you please. Where is Mrs. Malcolm, the surgeon?"
It would have been difficult for the seaman to look more alarmed, but at this question he managed it.
"I don't know," he said.
"You do," Jamie said sharply, "and you'll tell me this minute or I shall break your neck."
"Well, now, I can't be telling you anything if you break me neck, can I?"
the seaman pointed out, beginning to recover his nerve. He lifted his chin pugnaciously over his basket of manure.
"Now you leave go of me, or I'll call—"
The rest was lost in a squawk, as a large hand fastened about his neck and began inexorably to squeeze. The basket fell to the deck, and balls of goat manure exploded out of it like shrapnel.
"Ah!"
Harry Tompkins' legs thrashed wildly, scattering goat dung in every direction. His face turned the colour of a beetroot as he clawed ineffectually at Jamie's arm. Judging the results clinically, Jamie let go as the man's eye began to bulge. He wiped his hand on his breeches, disliking the greasy feel of the man's sweat on his palm. Tompkins lay on the deck in a sprawl of limbs, wheezing faintly.
"You're quite right," Jamie said. "On the other hand, if I break your arm, I expect you'll still be able to speak to me, eh?"
He bent, grasped the man by one skinny arm and jerked him to his feet, twisting the arm roughly behind his back.
"I'll tell you, I'll tell you."
The seaman wriggled madly, panicked.
"Damn you, you're as wicked cruel as she was."
"Was? What do you mean,
was?"
Jamie's heart squeezed tight in his chest, and he jerked the arm more roughly than he had meant to do. Tompkins let out a screech of pain, and Jamie slackened the pressure slightly.
"Let go, I'll tell you, but for pity's sake, let go."
Jamie lessened his grasp, but didn't let go.
"Tell me where my wife is," he said,
in a tone that had made stronger men than Harry Tompkins fall over their feet to obey.
"She's lost,"
the man blurted.
"Gone overboard."
"What?"
He was so stunned that he let go his hold.
"Overboard.
Gone overboard.
Lost.
When?"
he demanded.
"How? Damn you, tell me what happened."
He advanced on the seaman, fists clenched. The seaman was backing away, rubbing his arm and panting, a look of furtive satisfaction in his one eye.
"Don't worry, Your Honour," he said,
a queer, jeering tone in his voice.
"You won't be lonesome long. You'll join her in hell in a few days, dancing from the yardarm over Kingston Harbour."
Too late. Jamie heard the footfall on the boards behind him. He had no time even to turn his head before the blow fell. He had been struck in the head frequently enough to know that the sensible thing was to lie still until the giddiness and the lights that pulsed behind your eyelids with each heartbeat stopped. Sit up too soon, and the pain made you vomit. The deck was rising and falling under him in the horrible way of ships. He kept his eyes tight closed, concentrating on the knotted ache at the base of his skull in order not to think of his stomach.
Ship. He should be on a ship. Yes, but the surface under his cheek was wrong. Hardwood, not the linen of his berth's bedding. And the smell. The smell was wrong. It was...
He shot bolt upright, memory shooting through him with a vividness that made the pain in his head pale by comparison. The darkness moved queasily around him, blinking with coloured lights, and his stomach heaved. He closed his eyes and swallowed hard, trying to gather his scattered wits about the single appalling thought that had lanced through his brain like a spit through mutton. Claire. Lost. Drowned. Dead. He leaned to the side and threw up. He retched and coughed as though his body was trying forcibly to expel the thought. It didn't work. When he finally stopped, leaning against the bulkhead in exhaustion, it was still with him. It hurt to breathe, and he clenched his fists on his thighs, trembling. There was a sound of a door opening, and a bright light struck him in the eyes with the force of a blow. He winced, closing his eyes against the glare of the lantern. "Mr. Fraser," a soft, well-bred voice said, "I am truly sorry. I wish you to know that, at least." Through a cracked eyelid, he saw the drawn, harried face of young Leonard, the man who had taken Claire. The man wore a look of regret. Regret! Regret for killing her. Fury pulled him up against the weakness and sent him lunging across the slanted deck in an instant. There was an outcry as he hit Leonard and bore him backward into the passage, and a good juicy thunk as the bugger's head hit the boards. People were shouting and shadows leapt crazily all round him as the lantern swayed, but he paid no attention. He smashed Leonard's jaw with one great blow, his nose with the next. The weakness mattered nothing. He would spend all his strength and die here glad, but let him batter and maim now, feel the bones crack and the blood hot and slick on his fists. Blessed Michael, let him avenge her first. There were hands on him, snatching and jerking, but they didn't matter. They would kill him now, he thought dimly, and that didn't matter either. The body under him jerked and twitched between his legs and lay still. When the next blow came, he went willingly into the dark. The light touch of fingers on his face awakened him. He reached drowsily up to take her hand, and his palm touched... Ah! With an instinctive revulsion, he was on his feet, clawing at his face. The big spider, nearly as frightened as he was, made off toward the shrubbery at high speed, long hairy legs no more than a blur. There was an outburst of giggling behind him. He turned around, his heart pounding like a drum, and found six children roosting in the branches of a big green tree, all grinning down at him with tobacco-stained teeth. He bowed to them, feeling dizzy and rubber-legged, the start of fright that had got him up, now dying in his blood.
"Mademoiselle, monsieur," he said, croaking,
and in the half-awake recesses of his brain wondered what had made him speak to them in French. Had he half heard them speaking as he lay asleep? French they were, for they answered him in that language, strongly laced with a guttural sort of Creole accent that he'd never heard before.
"Vous êtes matelot?" the biggest boy asked,
eyeing him with interest. His knees gave way and he sat down on the ground, suddenly enough to make the children laugh again.
"Non,"
he replied, struggling to make his tongue work.
"Je suis guerrier."
His mouth was dry and his head ached like a fiend. Faint memories swam about in the porridge that filled his head, too vague to grasp.
"A soldier!" exclaimed one of the smaller children.
His eyes were round and dark as sloes.
"Where is your sword and pistola, eh?" "Don't be silly," an older girl told him loftily. "How could he swim with a pistola? It would be ruined." "Don't you know any better, guava head?" "Don't call me that," the younger boy shouted, face contorting in rage. "Shit face, frog guts, caca brains."
The children were scrabbling through the branches like monkeys, screaming and chasing each other. Jamie rubbed a hand hard over his face, trying to think.
"Mademoiselle."
He caught the eye of the older girl and beckoned to her. She hesitated for a moment, then dropped from her branch like a ripe fruit, landing on the ground before him in a puff of yellow dust. She was barefoot, wearing nothing but a muslin shift and a coloured kerchief round her dark curly hair.
Monsieur?
You seem a woman of some knowledge, mademoiselle, he said. Tell me, please, what is the name of this place?
Cap Echien, she replied promptly. She eyed him with considerable curiosity. You talk funny, she said.
I'm thirsty. Is there water nearby?
Cap Echien.
So he was on the island of Hispaniola.
His mind was slowly beginning to function again. He had a vague memory of terrible effort, of swimming for his life in a frothing cauldron of heaving waves, and rain pelting his face so hard that it made little difference whether his head was above or below the surface. And what else?
This way! This way!
The other children had dropped out of the tree, and a little girl was tugging his hand, urging him to follow. He knelt by the little stream, splashing water over his head, gulping delicious, cool handfuls, while the children scampered over the rocks, pelting each other with mud. Now he remembered the rat-faced seaman and Leonard's surprised young face, the deep red rage and the satisfying feel of flesh crushed against bone under his fist. And Claire. The memory came back suddenly, with a sense of confused emotion. Loss and terror succeeded by relief. What had happened? He stopped what he was doing, not hearing the questions the children were flinging at him.
"Are you a deserter?"
one of the boys asked again. "Have you been in a fight?" The boy's eyes rested curiously on his hands. His knuckles were cut and swollen, and his hands ached badly. The fourth finger felt as though he had cracked it again.
"Yes,"
he said absently, his mind occupied. Everything was coming back, the dark, stuffy confines of the brig where they had left him to wake, and the dreadful waking, to the thought that Claire was dead. He had huddled there on the bare boards, too shaken with grief to notice at first the increasing heave and roll of the ship, or the high-pitched whine of the rigging, loud enough to filter down even to his oubliette. But after a time, the motion and noise were great enough to penetrate even the cloud of grief. He had heard the sounds of the growing storm, and the shouts and running overhead, and then was much too occupied to think of anything. There was nothing in the small room with him, nothing to hold to. He had bounced from wall to wall like a dried pea in a wain's rattle, unable to tell up from down, right from left in the heaving dark, and not much caring either, as waves of seasickness rolled through his body. He had thought then of nothing but death, and that with a fervour of longing. He had been nearly unconscious, in fact, when the door to his prison had opened and a strong smell of goats assailed his nostrils. He had no idea how the woman had got him up the ladder to the afterdeck, or why. He had only a confused memory of her babbling urgently to him in broken English as she pulled him along, half supporting his weight as he stumbled and slid on the rain-wet decking. He remembered the last thing she had said, though, as she pushed him toward the tilting taffrail.
"She is not dead," the woman had said. "She go there," pointing at the rolling sea. "You go, too. Find her."
And then she had bent, got a hand in his crotch and a sturdy shoulder under his rump and heaved him neatly over the rail and into the churning water. "You are not an Englishman," the boy was saying. "It is an English ship, though, isn't it?" He turned automatically to look where the boy pointed and saw the Porpoise riding at anchor far out in the shallow bay. Other ships were scattered throughout the harbour, all clearly visible from this vantage point on a hill just outside the town.
"Yes,"
he said to the boy, "an English ship."
"One for me,"
the boy exclaimed happily. He turned to shout to another lad,
"Jacques, I was right, English. That's four for me and only two for you this month." "Three,"
Jacques corrected indignantly.
"I get Spanish and Portuguese. Bruja was Portuguese, so I can count that too."
Jamie reached out and caught the older boy's arm.
"Pardon, monsieur," he said. "Your friend said Bruja."
"Yes,
"'She was in last week,' the boy answered. "'Is Bruja a Portuguese name, though? "'We weren't sure whether to count it Spanish or Portuguese.'
"'Some of the sailors were in my maman's taverna,'
one of the little girls chimed in.
"'They sounded like they were talking Spanish, but it wasn't like Uncle Geraldo talks.'
"'I think I should like to talk to your maman, chérie,' he said to the little girl. "'Do any of you know, perhaps, where this Bruja was going when she left?'
"'Bridgetown?'
the oldest girl put in promptly, trying to regain his attention.
"'I heard the clerk at the garrison say so.'
"'The garrison?'
"'The barracks are next door to my maman's taverna,'
the smaller girl chimed in, tugging at his sleeve.
"'The ship captains all go there with their papers while the sailors get drunk. "'Come, come, maman will feed you if I tell her to.'
"'I think your maman will throw me out the door,'
he told her, rubbing a hand across the heavy stubble on his chin.
"'I look like a vagabond.'
He did. There were stains of blood and vomit on his clothes despite the swim, and he knew by the feel of his face that it was bruised and bloodshot.
"'Maman has seen much worse than you,'
the little girl assured him.
"'Come on.'
He smiled and thanked her, and allowed them to lead him down the hill, staggering slightly, as his land legs hadn't yet returned. He found it odd, but somehow comforting, that the children shouldn't be frightened of him. Horrible as he no doubt looked.
Was this what the goat woman had meant? That Claire had swum ashore on this island?
He felt a welling of hope that was as refreshing to his heart as the water had been to his parched throat. Claire was stubborn, reckless, and had a great deal more courage than was safe for a woman. But she was by no means such a fool as to fall off a man of war by accident.
And the Bruja and Ian were nearby.
He would find them both, then. The fact that he was barefoot, penniless, and a fugitive from the Royal Navy seemed of no consequence. He had his wits and his hands, and with dry land once more beneath his feet, all things seemed possible.
Chapter 52. A wedding takes place.
There was nothing to be done but to repair the Artemis as quickly as possible and make sail for Jamaica. I did my best to put aside my fear for Jamie, but I scarcely ate for the next 2 days, my appetite impeded by the large ball of ice that had taken up residence in my stomach. For distraction, I took Massali up to the house on the hill, where she succeeded in charming Father Fogden by recalling and mixing for him a Scottish receipt for a sheep dip, guaranteed to destroy ticks. Stern helpfully pitched in with the labour of repair, delegating to me the guardianship of his specimen bag, and charging me with the task of searching the nearby jungle for any curious specimens of arachnida that might come to hand as I looked for medicinal plants. While thinking privately that I would prefer to meet any of the larger specimens of arachnida with a good stout boot, rather than with my bare hands, I accepted the charge, peering into the internal water-filled cups of bromeliads in search of the bright-coloured frogs and spiders who inhabited these tiny worlds. I returned from one of these expeditions on the afternoon of the third day, with several large lily roots, some shelf fungus of a vivid orange, and an unusual moss, together with a live tarantula, carefully trapped in one of the sailor's stocking caps and held at arm's length, large and hairy enough to send Lawrence into paroxysms of delight. When I emerged from the jungle's edge, I saw that we had reached a new stage of progress. The Artemis was no longer canted on her side, but was slowly regaining an upright position on the sand, assisted by ropes, wedges, and a great deal of shouting. "'It's nearly finished, then?' I asked Fergus, who was standing near the stern, doing a good bit of the shouting as he instructed the crew in the placement of wedges. He turned to me, grinning and wiping the sweat from his forehead.
"'Yes, milady, the caulking is complete. Mr. Warren gives it as his opinion that we may launch the ship near evening, when the day is grown cool, so the tar is hardened.
That's marvellous. I craned my neck back, looking up at the naked mast that towered high above. Have we got sails?
Oh, yes,
he assured me. In fact, we have everything except... A shout of alarm from MacLeod interrupted whatever he'd been about to say. I whirled to look toward the distant road out of the palmettos, where the sun winked off the glint of metal.
Soldiers!
Fergus reacted faster than anyone, leaping from the scaffolding to land in a thudding spray of sand beside me.
Quick, milady, to the wood! Masali!
He shouted, looking wildly about for the girl. He licked sweat from his upper lip, eyes darting from the jungle to the approaching soldiers.
Masali!
He shouted once more. Masali appeared round the edge of the hull, pale and startled. Fergus grasped her by the arm and shoved her toward me.
Go with me, lady. Run!
I snatched Masali's hand and ran for the forest, sand spurting beneath our feet. There were shouts from the road behind us, and a shot cracked overhead, followed by another. 10 steps, 5, and then we were in the shadow of the trees. I collapsed behind the shelter of a thorny bush, gasping for breath against the stabbing pain of a stitch in my side. Masali knelt on the earth beside me, her cheeks streaked with tears.
What?
She gasped, struggling for breath.
Who are they? What will they do to Fergus? What?
I don't know. Still breathing heavily, I grasped a cedar sapling and pulled myself to my knees. Peering through the underbrush on all fours, I could see that the soldiers had reached the ship. It was cool and damp under the trees, but the lining of my mouth was dry as cotton. I bit the inside of my cheek, trying to encourage a little saliva to flow.
I think it will be all right.
I patted Masali's shoulder, trying to be reassuring.
Look, there are only 10 of them,
I whispered, counting as the last soldier trotted out of the palmetto grove.
They're French. The Artemis has French papers. It may be all right.
And then again, it might not. I was well aware that a ship aground and abandoned was legal salvage. It was a deserted beach, and all that stood between these soldiers and a rich prize were the lives of the Artemis's crew. A few of the seamen had pistols to hand, most had knives, but the soldiers were armed to the teeth, each man with musket, sword and pistols. If it came to a fight, it would be a bloody one, but the odds were heavily on the mounted soldiers. The men near the ship were silent, grouped close together behind Fergus, who stood out, straight-backed and grim as the spokesman. I saw him push back his shock of hair with his hook and plant his feet solidly in the sand, ready for whatever might come. The creak and jingle of harness seemed muted in the damp, hot air, and the horses moved slowly, hooves muffled in the sand. The soldiers came to a halt 10 feet away from the little knot of seamen. A big man, who seemed to be in command, raised one hand in an order to stay and swung down from his horse. I was watching Fergus rather than the soldiers. I saw his face change, then freeze, white under his tan. I glanced quickly at the soldier coming toward him across the sand, and my own blood froze.
"Silence, mes amis," said the big man, in a voice of pleasant command. "Silence, et restez, s'il vous plaît."
"Silence, my friends, and do not move, if you please." I would have fallen, were I not already on my knees. I closed my eyes in a wordless prayer of thanksgiving. "Next to me," Masali gasped. I opened my eyes and clapped a hand over her open mouth. The commander took off his hat and shook out a thick mass of sweat-soaked auburn hair. He grinned at Fergus, teeth white and wolfish in a short, curly red beard.
"You're in charge here," Jamie said in French. "You, come with me. The rest."
He nodded at the crew, several of whom were goggling at him in open amazement.
"You stay where you are. Don't talk," he added offhandedly.
Masali jerked at my arm, and I realized how tightly I'd been holding her.
"Sorry,
I whispered, letting go but not taking my eyes from the beach.
What is he doing?
Massali hissed in my ear. Her face was pale with excitement, and the little freckles left by the sun stood out on her nose in contrast.
How did he get here?
I don't know. Be quiet, for God's sake. The crew of the Artemis exchanged glances, waggled their eyebrows, and nudged each other in the ribs, but fortunately also obeyed orders and didn't speak. I hoped to heaven that their obvious excitement would be construed merely as consternation over their impending fate.
This ends Disc 27. Voyager, Disc 28.
Jamie and Fergus had walked over toward the shore, conferring in low voices. Now they separated, Fergus coming back toward the hull with an expression of grim determination. Jamie calling the soldiers to dismount and gather round him. I couldn't tell what Jamie was saying to the soldiers, but Fergus was close enough for us to hear.
These are soldiers from the garrison at Cap Etienne, he announced to the crew members. Their commander, Captain Alessandro, he said, lifting his eyebrows and grimacing hideously to emphasize the name, says that they will assist us in launching the Artemis.
This announcement was greeted with faint cheers from some of the men and looks of bewilderment from others.
But who did Mr. Freezer...
began Royce, a rather slow-witted seaman, his heavy brows drawn together in a puzzled frown. Fergus allowed no time for questions, but plunged into the midst of the crew, putting an arm about Royce's shoulders and dragging him toward the scaffolding, talking loudly to drown out any untoward remarks.
"Yes, is it not a most fortunate accident?"
he said loudly. I could see that he was twisting Royce's ear with his sound hand.
"Most fortunate indeed. Captain Alessandro says that a habitant on his way from his plantation saw the ship aground and reported it to the garrison. With so much help, we will have the Artemis aswim in no time at all."
He let go of Royce and clapped his hand sharply against his thigh.
"Come, come, let us set to work at once. Manzetti, up you go. MacLeod, MacGregor, seize your hammers. Maitland."
He spotted Maitland standing on the sand, gawking at Jamie. Fergus whirled and clapped the cabin boy on the back, hard enough to make him stagger.
"Maitland, mon enfant, give us a song to speed our efforts."
Looking rather dazed, Maitland began a tentative rendition of the Nut Brown Maid. A few of the seamen began to climb back onto the scaffolding, glancing suspiciously over their shoulders.
"Sing!"
Fergus bellowed, glaring up at them. Murphy, who appeared to be finding something extremely funny, mopped his sweating red face and obligingly joined in the song, his wheezing bass reinforcing Maitland's pure tenor. Fergus stalked up and down beside the hull, exhorting, directing, urging, and making such a spectacle of himself that few telltale glances went in Jamie's direction. The uncertain tap of hammers started up again. Meanwhile, Jamie was giving careful directions to his soldiers. I saw more than one Frenchman glance at the Artemis as he talked, with a look of dimly concealed greed that suggested that a selfless desire to help their fellow beings was perhaps not the motive uppermost in the soldiers' minds, no matter what Fergus had announced. Still, the soldiers went to work willingly enough, stripping off their leather jerkins and laying aside most of their arms. Three of the soldiers, I noticed, didn't join the work party, but remained on guard, fully armed, eyes sharp on the sailors' every move. Jamie alone remained aloof, watching everything.
"Should we come out?" Massali murmured in my ear. "It seems safe now."
"No," I said. My eyes were fixed on Jamie. He stood in the shade of a tall palmetto, at ease but erect. Behind the unfamiliar beard, his expression was unreadable, but I caught the faint movement at his side as the two stiff fingers flickered once against his thigh.
"No," I said again, "it isn't over yet."
The work went on through the afternoon. The stack of wooden rollers mounted, cut ends scenting the air with a tang of fresh sap. Fergus's voice was hoarse, and his shirt clung wetly to his lean torso. The horses, hobbled, wandered slowly under the edge of the forest, browsing. The sailors had given up singing now, and had settled to work, with no more than an occasional glance toward the palmetto where Captain Alessandro stood in the shade, arms folded. The sentry near the trees paced slowly up and down, musket carried at the ready, a wistful eye on the cool green shadows. He passed close enough on one circuit for me to see the dark, greasy curls dangling down his neck and the pockmarks on his plump cheeks. He creaked and jingled as he walked. The rowel was missing from one of his spurs. He looked hot and fairly cross. It was a long wait, and the inquisitiveness of the forest midges made it longer still. After what seemed forever, though, I saw Jamie give a nod to one of the guards and come down from the beach toward the trees. I signed to Massali to wait, and ducking under branches, ignoring the thick brush, I dodged madly toward the place where he had disappeared. I popped breathlessly out from behind a bush just as he was doing up the laces of his flies. His head jerked up at the sound, his eyes widened, and he let out a yell that would have summoned Arabella the sheep back from the dead, let alone the waiting sentry. I dodged back into hiding as crashing boots and shouts of inquiry headed in our direction. "C'est bien," Jamie shouted. He sounded a trifle shaken.
"Ce n'est qu'un serpent."
The sentry spoke an odd dialect of French, but appeared to be asking rather nervously whether the serpent was dangerous.
"Non, c'est innocent," Jamie answered.
He waved at the sentry, whose inquiring head I could just see, peering reluctantly over the bush. The sentry, who seemed unenthusiastic about snakes, however innocent, disappeared promptly back to his duty. Without hesitation, Jamie plunged into the bush.
"Claire!"
He crushed me tight against his chest. Then he grabbed me by the shoulders and shook me hard.
"Damn you!" he said in a piercing whisper. "I thought you were dead for sure. How dare you do something harebrained like jump off a ship in the middle of the night? Have you no sense at all?" "Let go!" I hissed.
The shaking had made me bite my lip.
"Let go, I say."
"What do you mean? How dare I do something harebrained?
You idiot! What possessed you to follow me?"
His face was darkened by the sun. Now a deep red began to darken it further, washing up from the edges of his new beard.
"What possessed me?" he repeated. "You're my wife, for the Lord's sake. Of course I would follow you. Why did you not wait for me? Christ, if I had time, I'd..."
The mention of time evidently reminded him that we hadn't much, and with a noticeable effort he choked back any further remarks, which was just as well, because I had a number of things to say in that vein myself. I swallowed them with some difficulty.
"What in bloody hell are you doing here?" I asked instead.
The deep flush subsided slightly, succeeded by the merest hint of a smile amid the unfamiliar foliage.
"I'm the captain," he said. "Did you not notice?"
"Yes, I noticed. Captain Alessandro, my foot. What do you mean to do?" Instead of answering, he gave me a final gentle shake and divided a glare between me and Massali, who had poked an inquiring head out.
"Stay here, the both of you, and dinna stir a foot, or I swear I'll beat you senseless."
Without pausing for a response, he whirled and strode back through the trees toward the beach. Massali and I exchanged stares, which were interrupted a second later when Jamie, breathless, hurtled back into the small clearing. He grabbed me by both arms and kissed me, briefly, but thoroughly.
"I forgot. I love you," he said,
giving me another shake for emphasis.
"And I'm glad you're no dead. Dinna do that again."
Letting go, he crashed back into the brush and disappeared. I felt breathless myself, and more than a little rattled, but undeniably happy. Masali's eyes were round as saucers.
"What shall we do?" she asked. "What's Dad going to do?"
"I don't know," I said. My cheeks were flushed, and I could still feel the touch of his mouth on mine, and the unfamiliar tingling left by the brush of beard and moustache. My tongue touched the small stinging place where I had bitten my lip.
"I don't know what he's going to do," I repeated. "I suppose we'll have to wait and see."
It was a long wait. I was dozing against the trunk of a huge tree near dusk, when Masali's hand on my shoulder brought me awake.
"They're launching the ship," she said in an excited whisper.
They were. Under the eyes of the sentries, the remaining soldiers and the crew of the Artemis were all manning the ropes and rollers that would move her down the beach into the waters of the inlet. Even Fergus, Innes and Murphy joined in the labour, missing limbs notwithstanding. The sun was going down. Its disk shone huge and orange-gold, blinding above a sea gone the purple of whelks. The men were no more than black silhouettes against the light, anonymous as the slaves of an Egyptian wall-painting, tethered by ropes to their massive burden. The monotonous heave of the bosun's shout was succeeded by a weak cheer as the hull slid the last few feet, drawn away from the shore by tow ropes from the Artemis's jolly boat and cutter. I saw the flash of red hair as Jamie moved up the side and swung aboard, then the gleam of metal as one of the soldiers followed him. They stood guard together, red hair and black no more than dots at the head of the rope ladder, as the crew of the Artemis entered the jolly boat, rowed out, and came up the ladder, interspersed with the rest of the French soldiers. The last man disappeared up the ladder. The men in the boat sat on their oars, looking up, tense and alert. Nothing happened. Next to me, I heard Masali exhale noisily and realized I'd been holding my own breath much too long.
"What are they doing?" she said in exasperation.
As though in answer to this, there was one loud, angry shout from the Artemis. The men in the boats jerked up, ready to lunge aboard. No other signal came, though. The Artemis floated serenely on the rising waters of the inlet, perfect as an oil painting. "I've had enough," I said suddenly to Masali. "Whatever those bloody men are doing, they've done it. Come on." I drew in a fresh gulp of the cool evening air and walked out of the trees, Masali behind me. As we came down the beach, a slim black figure dropped over the ship's side and galloped through the shadows, gleaming gouts of green and purple seawater spouting from his footsteps.
"Mon cria chérie."
Fergus ran dripping toward us, face beaming, and seizing Masali, swung her off her feet with exuberance and whirled her round.
"Done," he crowed. "Done without a shot fired. Trussed like geese and packed like salted herrings in the hold."
He kissed Masali heartily, then set her down on the sand, and turning to me, bowed ceremoniously with the elaborate flourish of an imaginary hat.
"Milady, the captain of the Artemis desires you will honour him with your company over supper."
The new captain of the Artemis was standing in the middle of his cabin, eyes closed and completely naked, blissfully scratching his testicles.
I said, confronted with this sight.
His eyes popped open and his face lit with joy. The next moment I was enfolded in his embrace, face pressed against the red-gold curls of his chest.
We didn't say anything for quite some time. I could hear the thrum of footsteps on the deck overhead, the shouts of the crew ringing with joy at the imminence of escape, and the creak and flap of sails being rigged. The Artemis was coming back to life around us. My face was warm, tingling from the rasp of his beard. I felt suddenly strange and shy holding him, he naked as a jay, and myself as bare, under the remnants of Father Fogden's tattered robe. The body that pressed against my own with mounting urgency was the same from the neck down, but the face was a stranger's, a Viking marauder's. Beside the beard that transformed his face, he smelled unfamiliar,
his own sweat overlaid with rancid cooking oil, spilled beer, and the reek of harsh perfume and unfamiliar spices. I let go and took a step back. "Shouldn't you dress?"